proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. Charlie Zadebsky for Petitioner Mehmet Egi. May it please the court, Mr. Egi asked that this court vacate the decision of the Transportation Security Administration or remand the decision for reconsideration. Your Honors, Mr. Egi has been flying commercially since 1993. He has logged 9,801 hours of flying time. That's about 1,633 trips across this country. He's been flying for Emirates since that time as a commercial pilot. The material that we supplemented the record with shows that he has a wife and two children. They are all British citizens. Mr. Egi is a dual citizen of Canada and Turkey. In his flying time, and in all of those trips, he's been the first officer on the plane, and he is now prevented from becoming the chief pilot because of the situation here, since he can't fly in, through, or around American airspace. Your Honors, all four of my grandparents came through Ellis Island as Polish immigrants. They taught my parents, who taught me, a few things. One, if you've got an issue with someone, you confront them and you talk to them about it. Two, you allow them to discuss your concerns with you. And three, you never talk about them in secret and ruin their reputation. The law teaches the same thing. We are taught, and in everything we do, we go through the practice of people getting fair notice and an opportunity to be heard. The proceeding that we are dealing with here is a black box. Mr. Egi has absolutely no idea of any of the allegations against him. He has no idea of the basis of any of the decision by the Transportation Security Administration, and he has no idea of any way to respond to any of those things. In a separate proceeding, we have been seeking, and this is not before the court, but I just share it, through FOIA to obtain documents from the Transportation Security Administration. For a year, we have not received any of those documents. So at the end of the day,
I guess we have an initial timeliness issue here, and that's my initial concern, is that it's outside the 60-day time frame because the letter was sent on January 22nd and the petition was filed on April 4th, which is outside the right time period, the 60-day time period. So what's your best argument for responding to that?
Judge Kavanaugh, that's a fair question. Mr. Egi was abroad. The letter was sent to an address that Emirates Airlines had. He didn't get the letter for some time after that, and during that time he had a medical condition. He did contact U.S. Counsel, and that was us. And as soon as we heard from him, we got his petition filed. The statute allows for a good cause exception. It's not an absolute jurisdictional bar. And we submit that there was good cause to allow for a few days. There's no prejudice to the government, there's no prejudice to the TSA, and there's no prejudice in getting anything done in this court, Your Honor. So our best argument is that a few days didn't harm anyone, and that because Mr. Egi was abroad and it took him a while to get that letter and contact and retain U.S. counsel, that those few days constitute good cause.
I guess there were 12 days from the time he received it until the due date, and the question is, question the government raises is, why wasn't it something filed in that time period?
That's correct, Your Honor. There were 12 days from the time that it arrived and the time that he was able to get the letter and identify and contact and identify U.S. counsel. So those 12 days, which are only 12 days, were used in reaching out to try and find lawyers in the United States who would take the case and file the petition. I believe that Mr. Egi contacted us, and the very next day or the second day after that, we filed his petition for review.
Well, isn't it also true, though, that they sent it to the address they did, because that's the address he told them to send it to?
That's the address that was with Emirates Airlines, yes, Your Honor. That's correct.
So you can't blame them for sending it to the address. He may not have gotten it, but that's the address he gave them.
No, Your Honor, I don't think there's any blame to be assessed against the government for that. I do submit, though, that it's good cause, that there's no prejudice, It's 12 days. It's not an absolute statutory jurisdictional bar. If the 12 days had prejudiced the government or somehow affected the case, then I would understand that. We had anticipated, actually, that if it caused the government an issue, they would have raised out an initial motion to dismiss the case, but they didn't do that. They chose to address it in their opposition brief.
Let me ask you about the jurisdictional issue that we raised and asked you both to brief, and you both are of the opinion that we do have jurisdiction. I don't see how suing TSA gives you the redress you need. Tell us how an order directed to TSA, because of the way this is set up with the FBI running the terrorist screening center and not a party here, how that would give your client relief.
Well, Your Honor, for three reasons. The statute, 49 U.S.C. section 46110, says that courts of appeal have exclusive jurisdiction to review orders issued by the TSA. We are appealing the order issued by the TSA, right, which is the second reason.
Frame what we would, if we ordered TSA retract that letter, how does that give him redress?
It's the TSA's implementation of what's on the terrorist screening database and the TRIPS information that prevents Mr. Egge, as I understand it, from being on the master crew list, and also puts him on the do not fly list and the terrorist watch list. So if the TSA was not able to implement the terrorist screening database information, then I think we would get the relief requested. Your Honor, but to be honest, it's also an interesting question, because one of the complaints we have here is that we have no access to any information, and the other courts have suggested that being in the United States District Court would allow the party to seek this sort of information and perhaps get some discovery as to what's gone on.
Your argument is we would need to construe your claim for relief to be in the nature of seeking an injunction against TSA, as the government suggested, would be potential a remedy that the court could order?
I think it could be construed that way, Judge Rogers, or it could be vacating the TSA's decision so that there was no...
But the order that you appealed, I understand it, the January letter, even as Judge Henderson was discussing with you, we set that aside. Where are you? That's just denying him, saying that we found no cause to change our mind. Seems to me you need more than that, don't you, to get relief?
You may be correct, Your Honor. It seems to me that it's the TSA's decision implementing the information on the database that we're appealing.
But they don't put him on the no-fly list, and they don't put him on the...
No.
So.
Well. No, they don't. Your Honor, I want to rest on the...
And it would be where the prosecutor relies on information that the FBI gathers. And that's the nature of the injunction, that the prosecutor would be told it may not use that information that the FBI has provided, even though the court has no authority to say anything to the FBI. Is that the nature of the sort of relief you're seeking? That's what I'm trying to understand. I mean, I'm just piggybacking on the government's argument in its supplemental brief and just trying to understand whether that's what you have in mind or not.
The relief we're seeking is either the TSA to reconsider its decision and allow Mr. Egge to participate more fully in that decision-making process, or to vacate the decision. It's my understanding that it's that decision that prevents him from being on the master crew list. It could be a difficult question because the government has taken the opposite position that it has taken in this case in the appeal from the District Court of Michigan case, which held that the case belonged in the circuit court. In that case, the government has argued that it belongs in the district court. Your Honor, I'm just about out of time, and I'm going to sit down because I've reserved a few minutes for rebuttal, and there's one other point I'd really like to address, and that's a recent case from the District of Oregon, and I'd like to talk about that for a minute.
All right. We'll give you a couple minutes. Mrs. Swingle.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. If I can begin with jurisdiction, I think meaningful relief is available in this court directly under 46.110, and to the extent the Ninth Circuit has held otherwise, we fundamentally disagree with that. First, I think, as Petitioner's counsel has made clear, the court could hold invalid the TSA orders that are being challenged here, the final decision of TSA, and that was a final decision by the TSA administrator regarding his request for DHS trip relief. We have addressed the merits of that in our briefing, and we encourage the court to do so if it's...
Let me understand. What is your understanding of what the order being appealed, what does it say and do?
Well, I think his challenge is not entirely clear, but I think he is challenging at least two TSA orders. One of those is the order making a final determination on his request for DHS trip relief. Now, the letter itself does not confirm or deny his status on the no-fly list, but that letter reflects a final decision by the agency that we agree is reviewable directly by this court, putting aside the timeliness problems. He also challenges what I think is an untimely decision by TSA removing him from the master crew list. And again, that determination is reviewable under 46.110. And then to the extent he's challenging the adequacy of the procedures that have been made available to him to challenge his asserted listing on the do not fly list, that challenges at least in part these redress procedures that have been set up by TSA by congressional directive.
Can TSA take him off the no-fly list?
Excuse me?
Can TSA take him off the no-fly list?
Well, I think, let me
answer. Just that agency. I know
I think the government would comply with an order of this court. If this court were to vacate TSA's final determination based, and again, I'm speaking hypothetically, on a decision that the underlying record didn't support his status, we would comply with that. We would remand, we would either provide additional information for the court, or we would take him off the list. If that's, I mean, and again, I can't confirm or deny his status, but the idea that somehow the identity of the named agency somehow means that the government would flout this court's holding is simply not correct. And I think, with all due respect, that just is not consistent with normal governmental functioning, and the Ninth Circuit was just wrong to say that because the government in its official capacity is named as one agency versus another, that the government would refuse to comply with the court's holding. So I think that's just not correct. I would note, too, that it leads to very strange bifurcated proceedings. In the Ibrahim decision itself, as this court may know, the Ninth Circuit actually transferred half of her challenge to this court for its consideration, which makes no sense. So we have two different courts of appeals being asked to opine on similar questions under two different statutory schemes that just cannot be the right answer, I think. And I would just ask this court to look at its own cases, which have routinely reviewed in the course of reviewing some final agency determination, some predicate determination or related determination perhaps by another agency. We've cited the court to Americans for Safe Access, where the court looks not only at the final DEA decision that is formally the subject of review, but also at the substance and the merits of the underlying HHS determinations that are binding in part on DEA without any concern. If I can turn just briefly to the timeliness issue, I want to be clear, we are not arguing that any time that an individual receives a final agency decision 10 days before a time limit expires, that cannot be reasonable grounds. That is not what happened here, and I think I would ask the court to look carefully at what has been argued and conceded. He acknowledges that the letter, the final decision, was received just a matter of 10 days or so after being sent at the address to which it was sent. He says it was received by Emirates Airlines on, I believe, February 4th. He apparently simply did not pick up his mail from that address for approximately 5.5 weeks after that time period. And I think our concern is that a timeliness rule that says that by not checking your post office box for 5 or 6 weeks. That becomes reasonable grounds for delay. I think that is a very problematic legal argument for the government.
Why not put in the letter that you have 60 days from the date on the letter to file? In the, this is outside your authority, but why doesn't the agency put that? It's the letter says this letter constitutes TSA's final agency decision, which is reviewable by U.S. Court of Appeals. Why not say I'm within 60 days of the date on the top of this letter?
Well, I guess I would just...
That would be sound government practice, I think, to avoid this kind of hiccup.
I think the concern, you know, under the 46110A's plain language, the 60 days runs from the date of the issuance of the order. The normal meaning of issuance is not...
I'm fine with that, if that's the way you want to go, but to at least put in the letter. I assume there was some confusion during the time when they were sorting this out after he got the letter about when the time ran from.
Well, he has not argued that there was any confusion.
I know, I'm just thinking more broadly about the
and of course I would
practice here.
This court has repeatedly held that confusion in thinking that a date runs from receipt of agency orders versus issuance.
I understand that. I'm just saying kind of intentionally confusing people is not, I'm not saying it's intentional, but leaving a gap in the letter that causes confusion that could be eliminated is not a great idea. That's not your issue, that's the agency, but to the extent they could put a little 60-day thing in there, that would be useful.
We would certainly take it back to the agency, Your Honor. And then if the court wishes to address the merits of the argument.
Well, let me just finish up your argument on timeliness. You say he failed to check his mail. The best I can get from the record is he said he had a very heavy international schedule.
Well, he points...
So my only question is this an issue that the district court should examine and make some findings on? Because we sort of had two conflicting views of this period of time. That's all I want to be clear.
No, Your Honor, I don't believe so. I mean, the question of timeliness arises only under 46110 once the petition is brought in this court. So I think, you know, he has the burden to establish reasonable grounds to the extent he would need to submit some sort of supplementary affidavit.
Like a manifest?
Perhaps, Your Honor. I mean, it's not meaningfully different than when a question of standing would arise in this court in the first instance. I would note, though,
I think it's just a question of, and I think that's the nature of Judge Kavanaugh's observation, of people knowing what they need to do. And if he needs to give us a manifest, fine, but that is his argument.
Well, I think this court has held that the burden to establish reasonable grounds for timeliness purposes is on the petitioner. He made no effort at all to do that in his opening brief, and to the extent he's made an argument in his reply brief, it's simply that he was busy.
A little more than that, but I'm just saying if he has a burden to give us a manifest, just as we've done in the standing area, we've said very expressly what we require so people aren't caught. That's all I'm getting at.
Yeah, I think perhaps, Your Honor, but I think to the extent he's identified any grounds, they're grounds that we would think as a matter of law, you know, a significant delay in retrieving one's mail because of a busy work schedule are not of a sort to constitute excusable neglect.
Can he file a new complaint with TSA that would trigger a new letter that would trigger them the same issue back here a year from now?
If he were continuing to experience travel difficulties, the agency's position is that it will not reprocess a new request for relief based on, you know, older travel difficulties that have already
but
been the basis.
Next week has a travel difficulty and files a letter.
He would be able to file it timely.
So he can get back here quickly.
If he were to file timely, that's correct. And then just briefly addressing the merits, Your Honor, obviously under this court's well-established precedent, as an alien with no property or presence in this country, Mr. Ege has no constitutional rights. And the kind of highly attenuated connections to this country that he points to are not adequate to give him rights under the Due Process Clause. Should the court reach the merits of his APA substantive challenge, we think the record adequately supports what the government has done. The court has no questions.
I just want to make something clear on the record. You phrased it more correctly than I did. When I asked you, does the TSA have any authority to take anyone off the no-fly list? That's the question I was asking.
Right. TSA, well,
I'm just saying, not Mr. Egge.
No, anyone. That's correct, Your Honor. And I do want to be clear about something. The final decision on Mr. Egge's request for DHS trip relief, once he went through the administrative appeals process, was made by the TSA administrator. Now, that decision was made in consultation with any underlying agencies that would have been implicated, but that final decision was by the TSA administrator. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. All right, why don't you take a couple minutes?
Thank you, Your Honors. We are going to submit a Rule 28J letter. There's a case decided in the District of Oregon, Latif v. Holder, on June 24th, just after we submitted our reply brief. In Latif, the plaintiffs, like the appellant here, were placed on the government's no-fly list and filed DHS trip complaints. There's a difference in that the plaintiffs were American citizens, and of course Mr. Egge is not. I want to read what the Latif court said on pages 59 through 60 of that decision. Defendant's failure to provide any notice of the reasons for plaintiff's placement on the no-fly list is especially important in light of the low evidentiary standard to place an individual in the TSDB in the first place. When only an ex parte showing of reasonable suspicion supported by articulable facts taken together with rational inferences is necessary to place an individual in the TSDB, it is certainly possible and probably likely that simple factual errors with potentially easy, ready, and persuasive explanations could go uncorrected. Moreover, there is nothing in the DHS TRIP administrative or judicial review procedures that remedies this fundamental deficiency. The procedures afforded to plaintiffs through the DHS TRIP process are wholly ineffective and fail to apprise interested parties of the pendency of the action and afford them an opportunity to present objections. Your Honors, we are faced with a black box. We don't know what the allegations were. We don't know what the facts are in the brief. We don't know how to respond to them. At the end of the day, what we ask this court is to apply its judicial knowledge and expertise and to look at the facts and the record and to ensure that the agency did not engage in an arbitrary, capricious decision or a decision that was not supported by substantial evidence.
All right, thank you.